The idea that everything has a technological fix may have no better example than the success of Apple's trademark. There's an app for that. And today, as programmers churn out limitless new code, there seems to be an app for just about everything. While many optimistically embrace technology as the solution to the world's problems, ranging from obesity to global warming, not everyone agrees. Many of those naysayers dismiss technological optimists as overly enthusiastic. But Yevgeny Morozov worries about the reverse, that technological fixes could, in fact, be too successful. In his latest book, To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism, Mr. Morozov describes the perils of a world in which we eliminate ambiguity and friction and perfect our behavior using big data and quick tech fixes. Mr. Morozov is also the author of The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom, which brought him here a couple of years ago. He writes a monthly column for Slate, and this new book is published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show.
Oh, good to be back.
You give a description of the world in 2020 according to how a Silicon Valley futurist might see it. What's it like?
Well, it's a world that a lot of people, I think, would find pleasant. It's a world where we can predict crime in advance and we can actually prevent it before it happens because we are surrounded with so much data about past trends of what has happened that we can actually dispatch police to potential location of crime before anyone even has thought about committing it. It's a world where through your smartphone you can get and earn points for participating in acts that you previously did out of good citizenship. So you would show up and vote, and you would be able to check in with your phone at the voting booth and get a reward. And I'm not dreaming it up, actually. It's sooner than 2020. Last November, one of the big thinkers on what's known as gamification, this is the trend to turn everything into a game and reward people with points, actually suggested that one way to boost civic participation in America is to precisely reward people with points for being good citizens and showing up to the voting booth.
And putting an app in their garbage can.
That's another example of how you can get people to recycle. So one interesting design project I found is something called Smart Trash Bin, or Smart Bin as they call it, which has a smartphone built into its upper lid. So every time you throw something away and then open and close the lid, take a photo. What you have just thrown away, uploads that photo to a website called Mechanical Turk, which is run by Amazon, where freelancers analyze what's in the photo and whether you engage in recycling-friendly behavior. And then they award you points, which are then uploaded to your Facebook because you're competing with other households.
I wonder if this is something that Russian immigrants to America think more about than others. Gary Steingart wrote a novel
in which
he predicted all sorts of outrageous things, some of which have already come true. But I wonder what's wrong with that picture that you described and what's wrong with being able to predict crime, for example?
Sure. So I think a lot of things are wrong, and they're wrong for various reasons. One of them is, of course, surveillance, and that's why I think a lot of us from the former Soviet Union realize that a lot of the systems that promise us perfectibility, they require constant gathering of data. So when you have a smartphone in your trash bin that records everything you throw away and uploads it to your Facebook profile so that you can impress your friends, it means that a law enforcement agency can go to Facebook and ask what was in your trash bin 3 weeks ago, which has never been an option before, right? You can go and examine trash that is still there. You cannot examine stuff that was there 3 months ago, right? So the smarter, that's the term of art, the smarter our environments get, the easier it gets to actually trace what's happening in them, right? To trace it retroactively. But there is another concern which bothers me even more is that when we use, for example, reward points and cash points and badges to reward people for good behavior, which now is possible because we're all carrying smartphones and we're all present on social networks, so immediately you can reward people for doing anything because the infrastructure for doing that is right there. When you do that, you no longer operate in the moral register. You no longer appeal to people as citizens. You no longer ask them to recycle because they care about the environment. You ask them to recycle so that they can go and impress their friends. Or you ask them to vote because they can earn some virtual points through which they can buy another app to do something else, right? It's the mentality of the consumer, which I think has its valid uses. But once you start applying it to things that used to be done for moral and ethical and political reasons, it crowds out morality.
But if it gets more people to vote, mm-hmm. is that really a bad thing?
Well, that's the trade-off, I think, that we need to decide on. It's okay to want people to do the right thing, but we want them to do the right thing for the right reason. And here, I think it's very important to understand that once we start relying on this logic of points and rewards in one situation, for example, and getting people to vote, we might need to rebuild the rest of our infrastructure and the rest of our world to have that logic. So you will no longer be picking up litter in the street without that incentive structure, right? Unless you're earning Facebook points, you will not move a finger as a citizen. And that was not the case before. And this is what bothers me so much about this.
Your subtitle is The Folly of Technological Solutionism. Did you coin the term solutionism?
I didn't coin the term solutionism. I found it in literature on urban planning and design, where, as we know, through decades, there have been a lot of technocrats and a lot of planners who thought that they know what the human condition is like and they can rebuild the infrastructure to maximize our happiness. And this is, I think, where a lot of solutionist impulses come from. But just to clarify, it's not solutionism. It's not just about finding technological solutions to problems. It's a feature where we actually start defining problems as problems based on the availability of our solutions. What I'm arguing is that many of the problems, quote-unquote, that solutions are trying to solve may not be problems at all. And we need to learn how to appreciate the imperfections that we have had in our world in the past and to save them from this perfectionism of digital technology, or else we risk a very bleak future, which I don't want to embrace.
Can you give us some examples of the problems that aren't really problems?
You know, take something like forgetting, for example, right? So with forgetting, now you can record and store everything, so you no longer need to forget what you did 5 days ago. You can always go and remember, how much time you spent with your kid 2 years ago. You can trace and run analytics on every single aspect of your life. And this is marketed to us by Silicon Valley as providing us more insight and analysis into how we live. If, however, you go and start thinking about the role that forgetting plays in making us who we are, it clearly plays an important role. It helps us cope with the world around us. It helps us, forget certain things. It makes us be inconsistent in certain behaviors and social situations, which I think is a positive thing. We need to make sure that those spaces for inconsistent behavior, for example, are still preserved, that we don't eliminate them through technology like Google Glasses, which will record and store everything we do, and which will then remind us that, hey, we need to be spending more time, or we need to be more truthful when we talk to that person. I find a lot of that a little bit too paternalistic.
Is that what Google Glasses are doing? I just thought it was another form mm-hmm. of miniaturization, the same way that what I've been hearing about
sure.
the latest thing from Apple, a wristwatch mm-hmm. a la Dick Tracy, that will do what an iPhone does. Everything just uh-huh. seems to get smaller and smaller as my eyesight gets sure. weaker and weaker.
Well, that would be, I think, a very nice scenario if that were the case. But no, Google Glasses will transform the reality you see. So, you know, Google will know what it is you're looking at. And if they do want to solve all of the world's problems, as the executives claim when they speak on the record, they would be able to make certain things disappear from the menu. When you show up at a fast food restaurant and Google knows that you've already consumed too many calories that day, it will just make certain things disappear from menu. They can do that now. The question is, should they do it? And listening to their rhetoric, my impression is that a lot of them are tempted to embark on solving all of the world's problems because they want to look cool. They want to look cooler than Wall Street. That only creates problems. They want to be the ones solving them because they're competing for the same talent pool. And it's important for them to look like digital humanitarians and not as digital thieves.
Now, people who criticize these sorts of things, what others see as progress, are often thought of as Luddites mm-hmm. or part of an older generation
sure.
on the wrong side of history. How do you respond to that?
I use technology every day. I'm very active user of Twitter. I do not think that anyone who criticizes certain technological fixes for embracing wrong, erroneous, or ugly logic is a lie. Right. What I'm criticizing is not the fact that we are implementing certain solutions through technology. What I'm criticizing is that we are doing it based on principles and philosophy and logic that someone like B.F. Skinner would have embraced if he had a lot of smartphones, right? The reason to hate B.F. Skinner is not that he used technological infrastructure when he had rats running through the maze. The reason to hate B.F. Skinner is that he had a very ugly philosophy of life. And this is also what I want us to understand, that a lot of these technological solutions are different, and we need to find a way to differentiate against them. We need to hate them, but we need to hate them for the right reasons, not because they're technological.
Well, in the past, we saw all the technological advances as having a positive mm-hmm. impact. They improved our lives. We live sure. longer than we ever did before. There are people who think that the way we're going to eventually deal with climate change mm-hmm. is through some technological changes. So we have, sure. to some degree, aren't we almost... haven't we been trained to trust technological advances? And then mm-hmm. we get things like smartphones. They make the world a lot easier to deal with, don't they?
But there is no inherent logic built into your smartphone. Smartphone can do many things. It can be used to reward you points, but it can also be used to make you think a little bit deeper about your consumption of electricity, right? Instead of just rewarding your points with it. So I'm not opposing the idea that we need to be using these devices to be solving problems that are genuine. Many problems are not genuine, right? Problems that are genuine can be used with technology and should be used with technology whenever possible. But we have to understand what are the philosophies and the principles driving them. In many cases, those are philosophies that if we didn't know anything about technology, we would oppose on political and ideological grounds.
Well, let's look at GPS, for example.
Sure.
I have a friend who hates GPS because she feels that we're losing our ability to read paper maps.
Mm-hmm.
But others would say, well, why is that even important?
Yeah, I would be in that second category. Again, I'm not trying to advance any romantic view of technology. In my book, actually, I advance this idea of technologies as not just problem solvers, but also troublemakers. I think we can have a lot of technology that will deliver some functionality. So think about, I use an example of an extension cord that was built in Sweden that looks like a caterpillar. And once you plug something into that cord and leave it on standby mode, it will start twisting as if that caterpillar were in pain, right? To encourage you to unplug it and to make sure it's not on standby mode anymore. It's completely unplugged, right? What that device does is that it provides you some functionality. It does everything that your normal extension cord does, but it also makes you think a little bit deeper about the broader technical and social system that allows electricity to get into your apartment. And we want more of such devices. We want designers to think not just about giving us the functionality that we want, but to also alerting us, even if in small doses, to the complex political and social issues that surround the use of the technologies that we use in our everyday life.
My guest is Yevgeny Murasov. His latest book is To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism. It's published by Public Affairs, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Yevgeny Murasov, who is the author of The Net Delusions, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom, which was a New York Times notable book in 2011. He won the Harvard Kennedy School's 2012 Goldsmith Book Prize, contributing editor to The New Republic. And his latest book is To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism. It is published by Public Affairs. Do you... think that in the future everyone will be able to write code and create programs that do things for us, or will we always rely on a select few to create those things?
Well, I truly hope that we wouldn't have to learn how to code. I think it's a dream, and it's a utopian idea that a lot of people in Silicon Valley are now advocating, that we all need to learn how to code. But I think it's as valid as urging everyone to learn how to plumb. There are, you know, institutionally, we have progressed by delegating certain things to certain institutions and keeping those institutions in check. I do think that Silicon Valley has built a lot of technological platforms that no one can scrutinize. We need to find a way to scrutinize and regulate them. We do not need to learn how to code. There are so many other important things happening that if everyone learned how to code, I think we would be then forced to learn how to fix our own health than to how to homeschool our own children. I mean, there are institutions that need to take care of that, and I'm very happy to delegate that function to them.
Well, some people say it would create a more democratic internet.
I don't think that you create a more democratic internet by having everyone learn how to code, because what creates democratic internet is basic familiarity with principles of democracy, justice, and fairness. We want people who are well-read and who know something about what justice means. Learning how to code will not get you to articulate a position on net neutrality, because those are all questions of politics. Unlike what Silicon Valley believes, those are not questions of engineering and science. You can know everything about the code, and you still will not know what's the best way to run an internet policy. And this is where we want people who know something about law and politics. But even that, I don't think that everyone needs to go and preoccupy themselves with those questions. I think there are roles for experts to play. We need to cultivate those experts. We need to have institutions in play, and we need to find other ways to regulate technology industry other than having everyone scrutinize every single line of code. I think it's regressive.
Well, we've always had people who knew everything about how to fix their own cars or who could build their own stereo systems.
Yeah.
And we have people today who are learning these sorts of things as well.
As long as it's something that you want to learn on your own, I'm perfectly fine with that. But again, you have to understand that very often this language of do-it-yourself culture and what a lot of people in Silicon Valley call hackability, it actually masks a political agenda where we're trying to dismantle public institutions and force a lot of those responsibilities on the shoulders of citizens. So now, instead of going to a doctor, you'll be forced to have a smartphone app that will monitor your pressure, and you'll have to take care of your own health, because hey, this is liberating and empowering. And of course, it's liberating and empowering if you're a billionaire in Silicon Valley and have a lot of free time. People who have jobs to do perhaps don't have time to spend 5 hours a day monitoring their diet. And this is why I think a lot of people in Silicon Valley fundamentally misunderstand how the rest of the country lives, thinks, and how much free time they have.
Well, learning code is more like being able to learn a language than providing health care.
No, because again, once you know a language, it's something that, you know, sometimes comes in handy, sometimes doesn't. When you know how to code, the assumption then is that you can go and start building your own appliances, you can go and start building your own servers, you can go and start building. I mean, a lot of those are useful things that hackers and computer activists, I encourage them to go and do it. I completely resist the idea that normal citizens need to take on those extra functions. I want public institutions to take care of that.
Well, even though the ability exists, how many people actually use it?
To do what?
To do any of the things that you're discussing here. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's available to me that I just totally ignore. And I assume pretty much everybody does that to some degree.
I don't think that that possibility will remain for a long time, in part because you have to understand how a lot of this devices work. So let's say I start tracking my health. And I start publishing the data on my blog that I'm a healthy person, my blood pressure is perfect. My insurance company reads that and they say, hey, why don't we decrease your insurance premium since you are healthier
Sounds good to me.
Than the average, right? Then another person starts doing that. So now five of us are tracking our own health. We are healthier than the average and we get to pay lower premiums. But then say you refuse to track yourself. Right. And then once enough people do that, your insurance company decides that if you don't track yourself, you have something to hide. So people who are actually most vulnerable don't have a choice not to track and not to participate, because if they refuse to participate, the assumption is that they're guilty and have something to hide. And this is what I hate so much about, you know, the rhetoric of we all have choice not to use those technologies. Well, try to be off Facebook and rent an apartment in any reasonable city these days, and I'll see how far you'll get. People think you're a maniac who just doesn't have any friends.
Isn't Meliorism, the idea that human agency can improve the world, one of the pillars of the Enlightenment? Is the solutionism you're criticizing any different from Meliorism?
I think it is different. Again, there are a lot of philosophers like John Gray, for example, who think that we just shouldn't even bother improving the human condition. We shouldn't bother with reform, you know, things are doomed. I'm not part of that circle. I do think that there are important problems that we can solve. Climate change, obesity, all of them matter. The way in which we solve them matters a great deal. It's one thing to solve those problems by giving everyone a self-tracking app, odometer, and tell them, well, now if you are fat, go and monitor how far you walk. But, and, you know, we wouldn't need to give you any infrastructure, just walk more. We wouldn't even bother building more public spaces of pavements for you to walk on, because all that matters is for you to be able to monitor how many steps you take a day. That kind of response I oppose. And I think we need to understand that, yes, there are a lot of good things that these apps and self-tracking devices can deliver, but there are still big structural institutional efforts that need to be in place for most of those problems to be solved. They won't be solved individually by individual consumers.
Well, you're suggesting that this is a case-by-case situation, because medical science has a solutionist approach to the world, the idea that every problem has a scientific solution. In fact, yesterday it was reported that the first baby was cured of HIV. Would you criticize those in medical professions who are looking to science?
I disagree with you. I don't think that the medical profession actually believes that. I mean, there are many conditions that you might have that do not adapt to a disease. And, you know, now if you look at how our healthcare functions and how our medicine functions, we start looking for diseases even when we feel perfectly healthy. I mean, the idea of health has been twisted to a point where if you feel no symptoms, you think that something is wrong with you. And then you start installing all sorts of tracking devices and you start monitoring your health until you discover what it actually is. I mean, health used to be that if nothing bothers you, let it go. Now, with the ability to monitor and constantly identify new symptoms which don't even bother you, and then go and buy new, highly customized, personally designed drugs to treat those conditions, it's a very different playing field. And of course, a lot of pharmaceutical companies are interested in funding those self-tracking devices so that you can actually go and discover new symptoms to buy new drugs. That's what's happening. It has nothing to do with science.
Are digital natives, those who grew up with the web, more prone to solutionism than previous generations?
So I don't like the term digital natives, but I do think that there is a certain idea, because, you know, I don't like it for a good reason. I think that a lot of those people have very widely divergent skills, and we shouldn't assume that young people are just by default naturally conditioned to use technology. But I think a lot of young people who have grown up on the internet, they tend to fetishize it. They tend to think that the internet has its own rules, it has its own spirit, and then it has its own logic. And then they would criticize any reforms or any interventions when it comes to defending privacy or attacking piracy. They would say, this will break the internet. This will not work on the internet. This becomes the default response to any policymaking, any proposal. And I think that, too, needs to be reconsidered, because we are blocking many important interventions based on some spiritual idea of the internet that we need to get away from.
Now, American politics seems to be broken at the moment, but what are some of the ways that innovators have tried to fix American politics through technology?
Well, I mean, we've seen one effort not so long ago to find a third-party candidate was this platform called Americans Elect, which people like Thomas Friedman, they advertised it as the next iTunes for politics. Again, that didn't take off because the problems with identifying a third-party candidate in America don't have to do with communication costs. They have to do with structural problems of the two-party system. But there are also various startups. There is one called Rokus, rug.us, which tries to bypass the party system entirely and allow people to form issue groups and then campaign on issues that they find important, and that way undermine the partisanship that propels the American politics. There are open government groups as well, which try to open up government. There are many efforts we can discuss here. There is no shortage of solutionist impulses.
And none of them seem to have been taking hold. But the Washington Post and MIT have both attempted to create real-time or close to real-time fact-checking applications. Yes. That's something to celebrate, isn't it?
That's something to celebrate as long as you know what those fact-checking apps are hiding, right? My problem is that a lot of fact-checking, as it happens in Washington, relies on a group of so-called experts who very often end up repeating the same talking points that you already hear from the White House. So if you go and poll a bunch of experts in Washington on the use of drones to assassinate Americans, they'll give you an expert opinion that may not actually be particularly expert-like, right? And when we go and try to evaluate the criticisms of some of the critics of the drone program, people who think that it's immoral or that we shouldn't be going after Americans, and you base your benchmark on the opinions of the establishment, who are presumed as experts in Washington think tanks, all these apps that we built tend to reinforce the ideological consensus. And we need to know that. If we know that, fine. I don't mind those apps.
Now, we have 15 seconds, so this is going to be tough for you to answer, but there's a debate about whether the Internet does more to mirror society or actively shape it. What do you think?
I would say mirror.
And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing as long as we know it. The Internet is a consequence of our society, not just its cause.
Yevgeny Morozov, Morozov, his book, To Save Everything, Click Here, The Folly of Technological Solutionism. It is published by Public Affairs. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you again.
Thanks for having me.
We couldn't get to everything, but it's been fun.